RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
My guest today is the graphic designer Marina Willer. She was born in Brazil into a creative environment with her architect father and French mother, a talented potter. Her formal education was under the Montessori method of teaching, where the emphasis is on child-led activities with children of varying ages, and with the teachers who encourage independence among their pupils. She later attended college to study graphic design, but spent more time involved in political activism, where she learned a lot about group collaboration. Her early career was first in graphic design, and then moving on to the world of advertising as an art director. But she was not creatively fulfilled. And during a stay in the UK, she looked at several universities for further design education. On visiting the Royal College of Art, she knew at once that she wanted to go there, and that wish was fulfilled when she was awarded a place with the substantial costs for an overseas student funded by a Brazilian bursary, on the proviso that Marina would pass on her design experience by teaching back home in Brazil. She honoured this by teaching for 3 years before returning to the UK to take up a position at the branding agency Wolf Olins, where she stayed for 13 years, only interrupted by a problematic pregnancy, landing her in hospital for 3 worrying months. She returned to Wolf Olins, where she worked on many major projects, including the high-profile Tate Identity. She eventually rose to the position of head of creative at Wolf Olins. A little later, Marina became the first female UK Pentagram partner and remains the only one there, something that saddens her and highlights the difficulty women still have in climbing the design world ladder. Marina brought a different approach to the more traditional classic work emanating from Pentagram. Hers is more playful and seemingly spontaneous, but always comes from a deep understanding of the client's problem, as will be discovered in this interview, along with the story behind the feature documentary film Red Trees that she directed to great acclaim in 2017. And centres on her father's plight following the Nazi occupation of Prague during World War II. We connected remotely with me in Dorset and Marina at her home in East London, and our conversation opened with me asking Marina to describe her approach to graphic design.
That's an interesting question. I think I describe myself as a designer, but with many different outputs and possible dimensions to the word design. Mm-hmm. And that means anything from film, playing a big part in it, filmmaking, film directing, but also identities and brands, as well as exhibitions and spaces. But of course, I always work with people from different mindsets and skills as well. So I'm not saying that I can do all these, you have to coordinate and direct and work together with a group of people that bring different inputs to what you create.
Today, being apparently the hottest day in the UK, is probably a temperature that you would have been quite used to back in Brazil when you were little. So I want to go back to Brazil, where you were born, and your mother is French and a painter. And your father is Czech and is an architect. So let's go back to you as a young girl in Brazil.
I grew up in the south of Brazil.
Right.
My mum does ceramics. She's a potter.
A potter, right.
But it's an interesting combination because they were always making things. My dad was always very engaged with woodwork and making things in the workshops. So I always appreciated that, and we always were introduced to a lot of those creative explorations when we were kids. And I think I saw it coming back to me much later in life once I went to the Royal College of Art, and how that environment, and particularly having had Margaret as a mentor.
So it was obviously because of their respective backgrounds, your parents. It was probably a fairly middle-class background, would you say?
Yes, I think very much. It's not like privileged at all or anything, but I know I find in any case there's a kind of privilege to have access to things that not everyone does, and be encouraged to create and read a lot and enjoy the idea that work and life are very intertwined, and not just get a job and make money and find a career that is successful in that sense.
So what was your, the childhood that you can remember sort of more clearly? I'm not suggesting, 2, 3, 4, but when you became aware of what they were doing and how it manifested itself in you, how you started to evolve creatively.
Yeah, I think I always was surrounded by quite a lot of design in a way. My dad was always very much of a modernist architect, and we lived in a house designed by him, and a lot of the furniture as well, and then a huge part of the house workshops. So where my mum would make ceramics and my dad would do a lot of carpentry that he enjoyed, and a lot of the toys we had were made by him or them. So I don't think you'd think about that at the time, but it more naturally connects with what you see as a potential way of spending your life, the kind of career you might pursue and all of that. It kind of by osmosis, I think.
Sure.
And we were always doing little things that were and having a lot of space to make things at home. So I now see that I, in a way, went a little bit back, full circle to that way of living.
And did you stay at the one house or did you move around?
We stayed. The thing that happened is my parents then divorced when I was 15. Oh. So until then, we had what seemed like quite an idyllic life altogether. And then after that, slowly things changed and we all grew up as well and went to live on our own, and me and my brother and my mum somewhere else. So that idyllic space kind of disappeared, one of the things of life.
I know from my own life those things can have a profound effect on you, particularly if life was sort of idyllic and then suddenly it no longer is. You grow up very quickly.
Yes.
So your brother, he is also an architect, I believe.
Yes, and he does a lot. He's a bit more leaning towards urban planning, but he's an architect.
So is he older than you or younger?
He's a couple of years, 3 years older than me, yeah.
So you were the youngest, just the two of you?
Yes, then my dad remarried and he has another child. So we have a half-brother that happened later in life.
So it's clear to me that the creative seed was planted in you from the year dot. If you're surrounded by a father who's an architect and working and you're aware that he's creating things and a mother who's potting, that you've got a head start on most people in terms of understanding what creativity is. I've interviewed many people whose parents just could not help them in any shape or form because they were just not able to even understand what these various professions were. So for you, when did you start to realize that perhaps this path could be for you? What was your early schooling like?
Yeah, I think it was all in the similar philosophy. So we went to Montessori schools. I wouldn't say they were ideal because, there's contradictions and maybe that particular one had, its own problems. But I think it was encouraging similar attitude. And to me, I think since early, I was quite interested in perhaps being an architect. And I think my dad just kind of disencouraged me because he thought there's too many of us in his house. I do. You are right. I think I don't take for granted how lucky I was. I think emotionally I do feel pain in relationship to the past and the family breaking apart. And I think still today, to be honest, it's life, isn't it? And we still see how we behave sometimes because of those things. But in general, I think also my dad, having come from Czechoslovakia then, he had a very humanistic education and very much, and my mom too. So they both were always encouraging a broad view of art and science and music and all those things of being key components of our lives. So I feel very lucky that I had that encouragement. And I always imagined that I would be something to do with architecture and design, nothing too different from that.
Were you very academic at school?
I don't know, to be honest. I think I wasn't crazy, but partly because the school wasn't ideal in many ways. I now see much later in life what my children's school is like. They go to a school that is really, really liberal and very like a model school, like Marion Duscher and Angus's children is mm-hmm. the same school. And it's very creative. And I think I always think, oh, I wish our school, it was meant to be like that, but it wasn't great.
Yes, I think Montessori had quite popular here in the 60s. It always had a reputation for being very free-spirited. In other words, you could do whatever you wanted. And the discipline was kind of zero. Was it like that for you?
No, I think it was a bit of a hybrid between the ideal but not always well executed. So it was a bit, yeah, sometimes, you know, we had contradictions and stuff. So I think we didn't, but it was still, you know, it's a school that cares about those things. And I feel lucky in any case that, you know, that was even an option.
So how long did you stay at that school, the Montessori school? Did you go on to another school before going to college?
When it got to high school.
Yeah.
That's how the system works there. Then we moved to a school that I was really disappointed with. I think my parents weren't paying too much attention at that point. So I think that the Montessori was better than what followed. But then college was also, I then went to study graphic design, but it was really poor course. So you learn a lot on your own. Mm. And the other thing that happened is I was growing up in a dictatorship, and that was a really key part. So when I became a student at university, I got engaged deeply in human rights and all of that. And I was much more engaged in that than the academic side because it was just not very good.
I'd read that you actually loved being at the college, but you were very unimpressed by the teaching of graphic design.
That's possible, yeah. And I think that we also felt that we needed to do our bit. So I was like in student union and doing a lot of workshops where you share what you learn with people in favelas and all of that. So you share. So we spend a lot of time creating things and learning from life, from each other, and also in politics. It was a bit still, it's not what the world is like today. I think we still inherited a lot of the utopian beliefs of the 60s, even though it's in the 80s. But at least the way things were there was a lot of belief that we could change the world. And so I think anyone half decent would really engage in some kind of activity like that, because it was just such a horrible scene with the dictatorship is back, very similar now with Bolsonaro. But,
yes,
you know, at the time, you know, we would see things and hear about things that were really terrible happening, and we had to do our bit.
So when you left the college, you, I think, moved into advertising. Is that correct?
Yeah, and that's partly because of the lack of good spaces to work with graphic design as such. And what was on offer was advertising. And I did that for a few years, and I was just really, I just didn't like it at all. And then I made a decision to come to Rock College and change life.
In the advertising job, were you working as they do here with a writer?
So yes,
art director and writer.
I was the art director in different agencies. I worked for a couple of years in two or three agencies, and always with a writer. So I did learn a lot. I mean, when I look at it now, what I was doing there is completely, you know, commercial and meaningless. But in terms of just the habit of being professional and delivering things and working with others and having to think ideas first, not just sort of style and decoration, there were learnings which helped me. But I think when I came to Rock College, I had completely changed my mindset and start again.
So what gave you that idea that you would move away from Brazil and come to London and apply to the Royal College? I mean, how did you?
So actually, when my parents were still together, when I was 15, actually, my dad decided to do a postgrad in London.
Right.
So he came to study University College, I think it was. So I moved here with my mum, and my brother stayed in Brazil. And that's when they got divorced anyway. But I did spend like, I don't know, 6 or 8 months in London as a teenager. That was the time that I decided what I wanted to do. And I went to visit places and colleges. And I was at the time really impressed with Royal College. So I then got that dream that perhaps if I worked hard, I could be accepted. And that's how it went.
And so you did. So the other college back in Brazil, was that, you know, a BA, bachelor's, and then you were doing your MA at you, because normally you have to have done a BA first before you can apply to the...
Yeah, and then what I was also teaching in Brazil and doing lots of things which helped me learn.
Yeah.
And there were amazing individuals. It's really not, it's just it's so complicated to get the environment of a good college. And in a country that was struggling with so many other things, I think a lot of the good designers in Brazil, graphic designers even, they come from an architectural background. It's now it might be changing, but for generations over 30 or so, they come from that. So if you see the ones that RG, for example, they tend to come from the architectural background. So I think that the courses were not very strong.
Yeah.
But, you know, people learn in different ways, and especially I think design can, there's many ways that you can absorb and look at problem solving. And then, of course, you have to work hard to kind of get it to mean something and the work to be good enough. But I was exposed to a lot since I was young, and as we were saying, with my parents.
Of course.
I think that influenced more. And then the side of politics and human rights, it's an incredible school for anyone to get involved in, because you have to try and understand the economics and the politics of not just that country, but how they connect and participate in some of those discussions. And all of that is incredible learning. I know it might not be seen as such for commercial organizations, but it does help you, I think, in life to think broader.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, working for a charity or organizations that are helping in areas that really need helping really expand the mind, because trying to communicate in those areas sometimes be very difficult, extremely difficult, and often it's done very badly. So I think anyone that works in those areas for the common good, it's a very fine thing to do. There's very little money, but nevertheless, you feel that you're contributing in some way in that. So at the Royal College, was it very political there, or was it completely dedicated to your task of...
It's interesting, because I think with some of my projects, I tried to be a bit more political, but I didn't feel that the environment was right, and also I had to perhaps step back from the old ways that I was doing things. So even though when I look at some of the projects, they were political, also the thesis I wrote at the time was very political, but I was also experimenting in a way that perhaps was more open and, you know, artistic as such.
What was your thesis on?
It was on political graphic design.
Oh, right.
You know, like the work of GRAPUs and groups that really helped to change society through the work that they did, and why, in a way, the irony or whatever was happening already in the 90s when it was 96. So how that was not so present anymore. I think the world was moving away from those beliefs. And we got to a much more nihilistic approach.
Yes.
But of course, different schools and these different schools of thought. But I was writing about that, which I enjoyed very much. So I did still follow some of that and still do today, because a lot of my work is for causes which are with a strong purpose and very anti-establishment as such. Not everything. But
no. When you left the Royal College, you went back to Brazil for a pretty short while. I don't think it was very long, was it?
I had this commitment to work in Brazil for a couple of years. So I went for almost 3 years, and I was teaching. So I felt, because I got a scholarship to come to Royal College, and
I
wouldn't have done without that. So I wouldn't be able to afford. And they, the government is like, it's not a government, but it's an institution that is public. So
that was the arrangement that you would...
You are granted a scholarship, but they want to invest in people that can give back somehow. So I then, I was already teaching in a university, and I came back and taught for 3 more years. And then I was also working on my own projects and so on. But I had already working links with Wolf Hollins in London, and also making short films for people in London. So I wasn't very fulfilled creatively back in Brazil. So I ended up coming back. And once I felt that I had done my duty.
I think while you were probably back in Brazil, did you not make a little short film called Cartas de Meia? Is that the correct pronunciation?
Yes, I did.
That one got an award, in the Best Brazilian Short Film Award in São Paulo.
Yes, it did. That was quite a political film, yes.
I did find it actually on, I think, YouTube. So it was interesting. Like, it was shot digitally, but on probably a handheld camera, a lot of it.
It's a bit of a mixture, actually.
So you then came back, and did you start immediately at Wolf Hollins?
Yeah, I had worked at Wolf Hollins a little bit after college, because they offered me a job, and I was still in sort of between having to go back and start the academic year and all the rest. So I started at Wolf Hollins, and I worked there for 4 months or something, and then I had to say, look, I'm going. And I had enjoyed it so much, and it was a very nice period of Wolf Hollins, I have to say. It was a period when I think much closer to what Michael Wolf would like have stayed as. Unfortunately, it was after Michael. He had left already, but, you know, he is someone, as you know, I know, it's a mutual friend and someone I adore, and I have so much respect. So I wish I had worked with him, and I can see getting to know him a bit after more that it held a lot of the values that he had set up for it to have.
Michael is one of those extraordinary one-off people that I can see could be problematic. I mean, he's a dear friend, and I first knew him as a client when he worked for W.H. Smith as a design advisor. And he could disrupt a meeting by just saying something like, look at this yellow bag. Isn't it fantastic? And everyone would look around.
I can imagine, yes.
I think that was when Selfridges first introduced their yellow bag. He was kind of besotted by it.
Makes sense.
He really loved it. When did you get married? Was it around this time?
No, it was much later, actually. We met after I'd been at Wolf Hollins for quite a bit, maybe after 5 years or something. Mm-hmm. Time goes quickly, doesn't it? Maybe it wasn't even that long. But we met in 2000 and we got married in 2007.
This is Stuart Watson, your husband.
Yes.
And he has his own studio and is a graphic designer as well.
Exactly.
I presume that's fine, simpatico. Some people that are in the same profession find it problematic.
No, I think we in the beginning, when we used to work together wonderfully, and then when we got involved with each other, we decided not to do that. But recently, we actually won the pitch for the Natural History Museum together.
Oh, really? Okay.
A collaboration.
Yes.
And we're working on that. And we worked on a couple of other projects where we each bring quite a specific angle, which helps. I think it complements. It's complementary, yeah.
Let's bring married life into this now, because I'm interested. Because you marry and then you suddenly have twins. Now, having one is bad enough, but having twins, having not had children before, I know from my own experience, is quite a shock. And so you both have to share the task, absolutely, you know, because they don't both wake up at the same time at night to be fed. They end up having different cries. And I, with one of my sons, I recognize his cry, so I thought that's my turn to get up and feed, and so it went on.
That's a division of labor, is it?
Well, I mean, you become so close to them that you know what their cry, they have
Absolutely.
Different cries, so
yeah.
If you got up for both of them, you'd be exhausted. How was the life work balance?
Well, I took 9 months. I think I started to slowly do a little bit of work after 6 months, but very light. And it was a really intense but wonderful thing. I think it started, our experience was a bit difficult because they were premature and they we weren't sure they were going to make it. We had a very difficult pregnancy, and you maybe know.
I do.
They had a thing called twin-to-twin transfusion when one takes the nutrients of the other. And so we had to do operation through the pregnancy. So there was, it was quite scary.
Worrying.
And I think the beginning was hard in any case for, you know, it was all too much. And I think I was quite overwhelmed without realizing you're just in hospital for 3-4 months and you don't even remember what.
No, that's tough.
What day of the month. Yeah. So, but, you know, now, it's just the best thing in the world after you go through the stresses and the worries, and they get strong and you can then start to enjoy that wonderful connection between two people. And yeah, it's really amazing.
Well, let's talk a little more about Wolf Olins now, because you started off in a sort of fairly junior position, I think, as a junior designer, and then you slowly graduated, and I think the Tate job came in. And I think, from what I understand, reading about it, it started out as very much a group, a collaborative thing. But you would always go up and experiment at the top floor of Wolf Olins.
Yeah.
By sort of hanging things and filming them and just generally looking at shadows and just trying to think of an alternative way from what would be the mark.
Yes, that's right. And I think we, you know, as first there's a sort of strategic piece to try and understand what the brief even is.
Yeah.
And we were working together with, we were working on this understanding of some kind of something that always made you ask questions, and how art interrogates, constantly interrogates and helps you see things in different ways. And so I started to express this. And I think I was still very influenced by Margaret Calvert at the time at Rock College, because I was doing a lot of experiments that I set myself to do at Rock College. Because again, it was so open at Rock College. You make whatever. But I think I had the wonderful Margaret kind of always inviting me to think more and more broadly, a bit like you're talking about Michael Wolf. So I kind of kept that spirit of the college, and was, I found a little room where I could do an installation every day. And with, they did like a pitch within a group of designers for different ideas for the brand. And then I was really young at the agency and everything, but Nick Sirota chose that route, and I think it was really lucky, because it set me in a way to, it does help define the way that you work and that people understand you working. You're not just kind of churning in, you know, a bit of this and that. You're trying to figure out a different method for every time, a slightly different way of approaching things that makes solution more unique to that problem than it would be to something else. So I think I was getting really, really lucky. It was the right time and that happened. And then a lot of other projects come because of that one. So you start to build, you know, a way of, not literally a way of doing things, but people already think, oh, she's, you know, going to bring something maybe a bit different. And you start to find work relationships that work well. And I think it was a very, very much a golden era still, because there were so many good projects at Wolf Olins, and a lot of charity work I did there as well, like Amnesty and Oxfam, the brand for those things. And also was big part of the team doing the Macmillan brand.
Yeah.
So I really cared about projects of that nature. And at that time, I think Brian was chairman there, and he also was quite passionate about some of those projects. So the agency did attract some of that, which, or at least the pitches for that kind of work. And so it's you know, a good coincidence.
I mean, I don't want to apply any style to your work, because I know that you like to look at a project as something completely new, explore it, and then react. But one of the things that's very clear to me is that your use of colour is very evident. Also, there is a slight analogue feel to your work. So whether it's cut paper or whatever, it's not the clinical computer-generated, polished thing that you see generated from many design companies, because, you know, that's the particular way that they want to work. I'm thinking of the sort of, you know, the Swiss school. There are a number of very good design companies in London, but they do stick very closely to a discipline rather than really breaking the discipline. I come from a publishing background where breaking rules was a kind of daily habit, you know, but you, as long as you know the rules, then you can break them and it's fun. Would that be right? Would you say that that's a reasonable description of your approach?
Yeah, and I think I see that design can be a very trendy activity and can follow fashion. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I feel that sometimes solutions are just decorative. They're not really trying to explore the specific problem in a way that is unique to that problem. Mm. You know, sometimes I also find it interesting that when I was going to college and I was doing a lot of film at the Royal College as AV and stuff, we were just before it was the end of the pre-digital era. So we still learn how to use rostrum cameras and how to process film and how to make film frame by frame on a light box, which is so different to create to the generation that comes after and is making moving image straight on digital. It's fortunate to have experienced both. And I often talk to people who went to college at the same time, and we talk about that because you know what film you would process to create things. And even the Tate one is very film-based. And we more recently did the Moholy Nagy Foundation, and that was all done with film as well. So even though it's not tangible as such, it's done through methods which are more like projection and light and water rather than just trying to create everything artificially with tech. I think if tech is like Rolls-Royce, we did also a couple of years ago, that was a project we used a lot more coding than anything because the precision and the need for that to be like that. But I think it was the right thing for that project. And I hope that I can be open-minded enough to embrace all kinds of solutions and not, but because I do a lot of things for fun, which are analog, it probably also emphasizes that, which isn't really work, but it's fiddling around and messing around and painting and things. I know you like doing some of those things. And those things, they feed the brain. And definitely, I think color, whether the project is colorful or not, I just find it odd when color is seen as an afterthought, when it's not an integral part of the process. And I'm not shy of colors because where I grew up and the intensity of light and color. And I think color brings so much movement and to form, and it brings energy and it brings storytelling and context that it's crazy to ignore it. But even though sometimes, like we did with Moholy Nagy, the project doesn't really need color as a final output.
It's funny because I interviewed Alan Fletcher many years ago before he passed away. This is long after he'd left Pentagram. And he was kind of like a schoolboy in that he was loving the way he was working there because he'd reduced everything to virtually analog. He would have lots of colored paper. He would spend ages, you know, making collages purely for his own pleasure. But he also almost eradicated typography in favor of his very scratchy writing. And so his final works were all done at the desk in the very traditional analog way. And he said to me, he was so pleased to be able to do that because he got so bored with working for clients. He just had got to that point in his life when he didn't want to have anything to do with clients, although he had one wonderful client in Switzerland, pharmaceutical company, that allowed him to do virtually whatever he wanted. But it's funny.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
He said to me he liked nothing better than going for a walk in the morning and looking in sort of shop doorways where they put out a load of cardboard, and then he'd get his knife out, which he carried with him, and cut pieces of typography and bits and pieces to take back to his lair, you know, to use as collages. That's what he used to do.
Oh, that's wonderful. I think Alan did, of course, for our generation. He left so much inspiration and that approach to design, which is really holistic, and the making of things and And there is a bit of a return to that because of the fatigue of this crazy Zoom world that we live in now, post-pandemic. I think the makers are coming in every direction. And, you know, I think there is, when you discover the joy of that, and even if it's not necessarily creating work as in client work, but it does influence the work for sure. Yeah.
I think there's a natural sort of merry-go-round that the younger generation will always start discovering the past that they never lived through and find it very exciting. So, for example, you get a lot of young designers now can't wait to get their hands on, you know, woodblock type and metal type, and maybe with, you know, Alan Kitchen, one of his workshops, because they're actually physically holding things and getting messy and doing something that you actually have to do physically rather than just typing on a computer. And it, they
it's
find
wonderful,
it. And the same with, the way film has been reintroduced. You know, so many students now have, single lens reflex cameras and have got some Fuji film, color film that they can push and make grainy and experiment with that and wait for it to, you know, instead of the immediate gratification of the iPhone, they have to wait for a couple of days to get the thing exposed and, you know, get a contact sheet. So for them, it's totally new, but it's
the wonder of all of that. You imagine if you didn't have it, and then suddenly all these doors open to you. It's such a thing. And sometimes I do get, like, in a podcast or something. Last week I was in a podcast, and this lovely designer who organized, he said, "Oh, you know, how do you keep using sketchbooks and stuff?" He said, I get a mental block when I open the sketchbook. I don't know what to do. And I'm always the opposite, because there's no censorship with sketch. You know, you can really ruin a lot of pages. It really doesn't matter. It's for yourself, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Oh, I think a little
so liberating.
A little notebook is kind of vital, because you can so quickly forget something that, you know, and I personally love serendipity, you know, when you can't, you're thinking, then you just go for a walk and then something happened and it sparks something off and you come back and, okay, let's press on. You were at Wolfhones for 13 years. That's a long time. Did you move directly on to Pentagram?
Yes, I was invited to come in as a
you
partner.
I was going to ask you, was that, did they come knocking at your door, so to speak?
Yeah, I was a member of AGI. When I was made a member of AGI, you have to do the talk, which was in Chicago. And then on that talk, Paula Scher, Michael Baruth, and Harry Pierce, they kind of said, "You should to become a partner."
Right.
So then it takes a while, you know, Pentagram is its crazy own structure. But eventually it happened. It took a few years, actually. And I felt so liberated, because I think I'd been on the same journey for too long. I think that everything was amazing about Wolf Orleans, but it's just, there's a point where you become a little bit established, and the structures and there's all these mechanisms in place, they were sold to a group. So all of those things take a lot of the freedom that we used to have. And at the end, I just felt that more of my time was used in management than really being hands-on. And I think at Pentagram, even though you have to look after your own little business, you are also creating all the projects. It's your responsibility. So I do that with the team around me, never alone, with them. And it felt really liberating.
So you were,
that's now 10 years.
Yes, and you were the first female partner in the UK. And then you were joined a few years ago by Astrid Stavro, who has since left. So you're still the only remaining female partner. Does that concern you that they're not?
Yes, and I'm always trying to change that, and it will change. I think it's just quite a complex set of, I don't even say skills, it's just the type of, you know, you have to have a good balance of experience and creativity and being able to do business as well as, you know, the work that everyone considers of that caliber. And it's hard, because a lot of the really amazing, talented women are working in their own small studios and would find it hard to have that pressure. And you also am aware that a lot of people abandon or put aside their careers, women, because when they have children, there isn't enough support in the UK for them to be able to continue work. And I think you don't then get to the level of experience. So there are many things that get in the way, but we are constantly trying to figure out and talking and about it. And, you know, I'm sure it will change quickly. We've had a really wonderful wave of new partners, including Astrid, who I was really proud to bring in. But I know that for her, it was very stressful. And, you know, it's not for everyone. I know that is the combination of being able to carry some weight and stress as well as do work that really makes you excited.
Well, let's talk about a couple of projects that you have done at Pentagram. There's the Battersea Dogs and Cats Home now. It always used to be called just a dog's home, but they include cats now. Is that right? But you did this very surprising and endearing identity, which sort of changes a bit. You know, there's a little animated sequence that where things move around. That was a very nice one. And then you then work for Maggie's, where you'd use different sort of little, I assume they were sort of graphic representations of buildings, you know, sort of different shapes with Maggie's just written, handwritten in a more immediate style. And having been to some of the Maggie's myself, they are amazing places, what they do and how they not only invite the person suffering with cancer, but their families, and they always have food, coffee place, you can make your own coffee. It's a wonderful thing, and they're dotted around the country. So that must have been a rewarding job for you to be involved with.
Yeah, I think actually Maggie's happened a bit earlier, but it took a bit longer to fully come to the world, and just because of their own issues with the digital team and stuff. But both of them were real joy to work with. I still work a lot with Laura Lees, the Maggie's founder, and I'm really happy to have had that. And in a way, they, having worked on the team that did the Macmillan cancer support, they were looking for something quite different because they thought that was a little bit too pushy and confident and almost blockbuster as a charity, and then this next is a more gentle kind of style, but still also the physical spaces are so fundamental to their offer. That's why we did these graphics that really show that, you know, these spaces are modern and they have an open door always. There's no door in the way that they don't have receptions or anything. You just walk in.
That's right.
And the type is done by Sarah Fanelli, actually, who is a very, very, very dear friend from college, my best friend. And you can see, and we wanted that the type to have a good balance of not being childish, being a bit like an architect's writing, a bit like, because that Maggie's herself was an architect and landscape
designer. Right.
And the Battersea, you can really see the connection of the things I do with my twins when they were smaller, the printmaking and the mark making. That completely influenced the solution that we then decided to propose, which is quite handmade and not too,
not corporate and cold.
Corporate, yes, exactly. Not.
You also moved, I don't think I've known you to be really an editorial designer, but you then worked on the project Sight and Sound, which I've been I've subscribed to that for 20 years. And then suddenly this new one arrives that's slightly bigger and will no longer go into the boxes that I've got, but it doesn't matter. How did you find that? Because that's quite a complicated thing to do.
Yeah, I don't think I have the, I was a bit nervous even of, but we, they came to us, it was a pitch again, and I think because of the arts and culture sort of brands such as Serpentine, or I think by then I had done a couple of designs of exhibitions like the Ferrari exhibition at the Design Museum and maybe the Kubrick exhibition as well. So those are all sort of storytelling and kind of creating a strong narrative. And I think they wanted to come from a brand perspective. So, and the creative director of them at the time at Sight and Sound, she was very keen to make that shift, that it wasn't just a publication, but it became a more holistic brand, and that eventually, hopefully, they'll even have their own website. At the moment, of course, there's always a bit of a tension and between them and BFI, because they are part of BFI. Mm-hmm. And they're proud of that, but they also want to feel that they're not just working within that framework, that they can have their own voice to a certain extent. So that's how we approached, and we looked at it very much as a brand. But then, of course, at the same time, working at the magazine design and trying to understand what that needed to do. And it's a very, despite it being for cinephiles, I think it also wants to be quite mainstream, to the point that you would remember the previous design was very much like Time Out. And it was difficult to even, it needed to become a little bit more of a collector's item to be appreciated again for its quality of, for its editorial quality. Mm. So we kind of, once you define the brief, then you start to look at what that should look like and how we can do that, but not be too trendy or too something that will be out of time soon.
You actually moved back, didn't you, to an earlier masthead?
That's right. Yeah, we did. And this is something that I think we always try to go back to the heritage and the history of a brand as such. We did that with Rolls-Royce as well. We try to go back to what the DNA of the brand is and see whether there's things there that have been lost. And something we discussed a lot with the when they brought a new editor and how that part was important, that bringing back the essence of it because it got a bit diluted. So it made sense, and also it felt like contemporary again, that look and feel, and allowed us to create a language around it that was very much coming from the world of film. Mm. I think they, even though they do all the different streaming and digital, they still very much love film and celebrate film in even its theatrical form as something very special.
Oh, yes, yes. And while we're still on film, step back. You did the Stanley Kubrick show at the Design Museum using that single point perspective idea that was so evident in his films all the way through his life. When you're working on exhibitions, as you've done several, are you just involved with the graphic content, or do you handle the structural design or work with somebody else at Pentagram that deals with that? How does that work?
So we create the overall vision. So we treat very much like a brand. So you create a narrative for the entire exhibition. Mm. So we created the idea for Kubrick, for example, which had this single point perspective. And once you cross that channel that draws you in, like these films absorb you, then you go behind the scenes, and then the room behind was very much a maker's room, and it had all the things that Kubrick had in his house, his editing suite, and all the typewriter, all the boxes that he used to catalog his many things. So all that wonderful material was there behind the scenes. So and then you walk into each of the film spaces, but I think that base of his mind and all of that. So creating that narrative is really important. And we had an architect to support us so that, okay, we sketch, and then you need the structural design reflect, and that delivers that in the best way, because we know we're not neither engineers or artists. So we always get the support. But I think it's important that one partner, even when we collaborate the Pentagram, one partner is owning the project so that they can keep moving on, because it can be quite complicated when you've got too many cooks. So that's how we collaborate with other partners. It's always one kind of being the you know, in the client contacted.
Yeah, of course, Andy. So that's the way you normally would do it. You if there is somebody within Pentagram that has the discipline that you need, you would work with them if you feel that they are right for the job. Or would would you work externally with someone else? Would you choose someone else externally?
In Kubrick, we worked with Will Russell, who used to be a partner, actually.
Right. Okay.
So even though he wasn't anymore, We know how he works. We know that he's also as a person is absolutely wonderful, and that he would be okay. He was there in the meetings and everything. It's not like the undermining at all. It's just knowing that we need to be there to make sure we deliver everything and we don't burn the budget completely, which we tend to do in exhibitions. Yeah. It's very hard. But, yes. You know, there's that responsibility of delivering that one person has to have. And that's how we do it all the time. And now we've got John Marshall, who's incredible, 3D and product design and all of that. So often there's opportunities to collaborate with him when you're creating spaces and thinking about environment.
Well, let's stay on film now, because let's just go through some of the things you've done. I already mentioned the film that you did for the Brazilian Short Film Award in São Paulo in 2003. Then you started to do these little films for Richard Rogers for the Pompidou Center, which are very lovely graphic, short, little, semi-animated, or sort of like an endless x-ray tracking shot, one of them that I looked at.
Then they are actually filmed, but it's, yes. No, it looks, because we shot, that is weird, because we actually chopped these objects in a half so that we could see the insides, like Richard used to, used to talk about.
Love the, he always preferred the inside, which is why it ended up on the outside.
Yes.
I want to move on to thing that I'd really like to spend a little time on before we end is Red Trees. I came along to a private screening that you gave in 2018, I think, or maybe 17, I can't remember which, but I found the film extremely moving and beautiful. And I was taken by the fact that you'd worked with the Uruguayan cinematographer, César Chalon, who shot City of God, which is a fantastic film. How did that come about? Did you know him or...?
Yeah, that's an odd one. In my brief time in Brazil after our college, I was making little films, but I kept getting commissioned by big advertising agencies and I didn't enjoy that. But in that period, I got to work with César and he saw some of the parallel things that I've been doing since the Royal College and some of those more individual pieces. And he said, whenever you've got things like this going on, I want to be part of it.
Ah.
So when I did that film that you saw, the one about the Cartas na Mãe, the one about that we did in Brazil, he was very upset that we didn't call him to do it. So when the other film came about, when finally I sort of got brave to work on the film about my father, I invited him then and we worked together. There was another cinematographer who played as much as a big role as César couldn't commit long time. He was then too much of a pop star.
Yeah.
But he did some very important moments in the film, which I think helped establish the style of it.
Well, tell me about the setting up. Did this film start as a crowdfunded thing or
yes.
not? Because filmmaking is not cheap.
It was lucky, I think, because I had been wanting to do this for a while because just in talking to my father and thinking about how the world had been going. And that was before Brexit, before Trump and all these things. But you could see the escalation of intolerance and racism and all the things that happened in the 30s and led to the Second World War. In a way, there were lots of scary parallels. I think I just was always thinking I'd like to do a short film about that. But because it touched on things like the Holocaust and very difficult parts of history, I didn't know if I had if I was prepared enough. You know, I didn't take that lightly. But eventually, I just felt it was the time. And my dad was getting to the limit of when he could really tell that story with clarity, and also the children were still in a good phase to be able to enjoy the process. So, and then I started as a crowdfunding, but a producer from New York saw the little video and they got in touch and they said, look, I think you should make a feature and we would be happy to support with the funding for it. So that's how it became a feature film. I didn't have that ambition or courage on my own. I don't think I would have done. And I think it then grew to become a bit different to what it was originally, which hopefully is a good thing. And then he then sold it to Netflix and all of that. So that money, we obviously, we didn't make any money. We lost a lot, but not, but we could make it, which was amazing. Mm. And they then had their own deals.
Did it take a lot of your time out of Pentagram?
It did. I was under a contract, so I had a little bit of payment every month, and I managed to do other work then. So I didn't make a loss at Pentagram, and my partners were wonderful and supportive. I think if I'd made a loss, it would be more difficult to, you know, you have to make your numbers every year. And so the combination of projects I had, and because I wasn't working for free for that, there was a bit of income coming to Pentagram. So it became a Pentagram project as such.
Now you wrote it, didn't you? Or you co-wrote it, or wrote it first, yeah, and then worked with another writer. And so how did you...
Yes.
What was the preparation in terms of your thoughts about how this film should look? Did you have a sort of storyboard, or a sort of then break it down into shots? How did you work with the cinematographer?
So I knew that my dad had written his memoirs. So we started with that. And of course, the memoirs then are a bit difficult to penetrate and da da da. So I then started to work with a couple who are both writers and friends, and we started to kind of, I had a vision for how I wanted the visual narrative not to be an illustration of the verbal narrative, but a complementation of it. So that's how we started to work. And we started to edit down, and also then add a lot of my own angle and commentary and things that make it a bit more like a documentary. Some of that wasn't really written by me, because it was just talking about what I was seeing. And But I very much was a collaboration with Brian and Lena.
It was sort of broken down into your views of your father in your terms, and then his own voiceover about certain issues, and then the younger voice was Tim Pigott Smith, who has the most wonderful voice. He's a fantastic actor as well as being a fantastic orator. It's so sad that he died as well, but I mean
he died just before we launched the film, which
was terribly
heartbreaking, and it was his last film.
But it's interesting, when you listen to his voice, there is almost a finality in the delivery. It's almost, I'm not saying fitting that he should die, that would be awful, but somehow it's almost like perhaps on his mind he knew that this might be one of his last things. I don't know. But it has that sense of loss.
Interesting. I never thought. But it was very moving, because then probably the same screening that you came to, his wife, widow, and his son were there, and they were so moved. And then, of course, they watched a few times, but they after they said it was almost too much for them.
Yes.
But I think then there was a dilemma, because he's quite grand in his acting. And
yes.
And that added the dignity to that generation, which I think that I was dwelling a bit, because he could go much more casual, you know, natural and speak like we're speaking. Mm. But in a way, you can't take for granted the epicness of what they went through, not particularly my father, but that entire generation. And I think that was why it made sense to have someone that had a bit more weight in the way that he delivered the words.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think that for me was one of the big surprises, you know, because documentaries quite often are not broken down like that. And interesting, you might be interested to listen, that Eliot's The Wasteland poem has been dramatized in sound on BBC Radio 3 in binaural sound. That's three-dimensional sound. And if you use a good pair of earphones and listen to it, it is just astonishing, because a poem that, on the occasions that I've read it, really found it very difficult, suddenly it comes to life with about five different actors all taking up, because it's like a fragmented poem of random thoughts.
Oh, wow.
And it's brilliant. You must. I'll send you the link after. So do you intend ever to make another film?
I don't know, but after that, well, I did start a new project in terms of, because you asked a bit about the script, and it came very much writing, but images are coming in your head, and because we are film image makers and you, myself, we, you know, as designers, I was almost writing the script and the description of what would go with that. And then, of course, it changes with time, but there was always a plan, but not a storyboard, but there was a plan of what kind of image and reference, lots of references of true photographers and so on. So we then started a new project, but I with the pandemic, I stopped, and many things were happening that I wasn't so sure that it was the right thing to do anyway. But I still love film and all of that. But at the same time, I think that one film was so motivated by personal circumstances. And I feel that I really have to be really passionate about the story I want to tell. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I don't feel that I have. It's not like a filmmaker that does that as a job and every year you need to deliver this, which is not a criticism. I think that's people who are really professional. And I don't want to underestimate what it takes to make, especially a feature film that is worth anyone watching. So I think it depends on if things happen, but it's not like I'm not planning for it. I really enjoyed, but it was very, very difficult to do it.
Well, Marina, tell me, what was it like when your father saw the film for the first time?
So that was quite a moment. I went to Brazil, I think by then, because the film was released in cinemas in Brazil, like a bit like the Curzon kind of type of cinema.
Yeah.
So because Brazil has quite a progressive intellectual community, and a lot of them are Jewish or came from this mixed background. So I think it resonated. And so it was in cinemas everywhere. I think it was, I'm confused now, but or before we ever launched it out, I thought he has to see it. And so we, myself, my brother, who was like a big support on this, he was, I called him the executive producer. Then my dad, we sat and watched on a big screen.
Yeah.
And he was, because he's, and the film talks a little bit, he finds it very hard to talk about the issues of the war. And so he didn't like jump up and down or anything. But he after it, it opened up like he wouldn't stop. It's like some kind of therapy. And he wouldn't stop talking. But also during the film, he was very engaged. So we went to film. I was constantly recording with him. And I think it gave him a purpose in life in that stage, because he was already suffering from Parkinson's, which now is quite very, very advanced. But he was already, you know, in a bit of forgetting and difficulty to. We couldn't have recorded all the voice with him. It wouldn't have been possible. But we did record a lot just to have the option. And in recording, I learned so much about him.
Yes.
It was incredible, the experience. I'd never thought about that aspect of how, you know, it gave a closing to a relationship. Not closing, but, you know, so much that I used the track Treaty from Leonard Cohen in the film, because I think it was a little bit of, you know, learning about why your father deals with emotions in the way that he does, and how it comes from that experience that profoundly marks as a child to go through that. It defines so much of how you end up behaving.
Well, I mean, as you've said earlier, he became more animated after. It was obviously some kind of release of keeping all that inside you for so many years, and, you know, not talking about it to your closest even. So that must have been a, you know, very special moment for him. And the fact that you were able to capture so much before, sadly, you know, he's developed another one of these awful diseases that take people away from you, which is terribly sad.
That generation is going, isn't it?
Yes.
And that's also a fear for the world, because the witnesses of that, it's been transferred to other generations, but the few who are still living, they are at the end of their lives. It's just the way it is. And it does put the responsibility on us coming after.
Yes.
To kind of not let the world forget that happened.
It's funny, isn't it? We live now in a world where everyone shows and tells everyone everything about themselves through TikTok, you know, all those things. And yet the previous generation were very almost closely guarded everything. They didn't want, particularly in this country, You know, they're very reticent about being too enthusiastic or too arrogant. You know, it's so English. We're coming to the end now. You'll be pleased to hear. are there any areas that you would like to work in that you so far haven't been able to? That's sort of anything that's nagging at you, thinking I'd love to get involved with something like that?
I don't know, actually. I think I just enjoy work so much because it's interconnected with life. And I think more and more, I mean, I'd love to create something of the scale and commitment as Red Trees, but I just try to be a bit more relaxed about my ambitions and kind of go with the flow.
Yeah.
But I think I love film, but I only enjoy film when it can be quiet. And even working with Richard Rodgers, which I did for 15 years,
yeah,
was always making films that were really different to just something that I think other people might do better than me if it's a little bit more conventional side of film, because I don't even have skills to do some of those things. But if it is a little bit of a different narrative, then I feel it's coming from a different angle, and then I'm comfortable, and it's what it's meant to do anyway, is to disrupt a bit the comfort zone, I guess.
Yeah, well, I hope you do. It would be interesting to see what would happen next. Each year, something like 30,000 design graduates are unleashed in the UK. So do you have any words of wisdom that you could offer them?
I always say you need to stay curious and find your own ways to explore. And you use the words to define. You said you every time there is some project, you have to explore and find a different journey to get to the result that you can't predict. So I think the curiosity and trying to not just follow the same steps every time is so important.
That's good advice. So what is the project that you're currently working on that you're excited about?
I think one of them is the Natural History Museum, which is just such a beloved institution.
Yeah.
It's challenging as a project. It's not been very easy in terms of the scale and the sort of the way the organization is so big that it's difficult to navigate. But we're very happy with the way it's coming together. And I hope, this has been something that's taking a lot of my time. But there's quite a few other projects that they're all really interesting. We're very lucky that things come our way and never take for granted.
Well, I look forward to seeing them all when they come to fruition. Marina Willer, thank you very much for sharing your RDI insights. It's very good of you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mike. That was really a real pleasure too.